Yeah, we have four argued cases this morning. Two of them are consolidated for purposes of argument. Those are number 21-12-29, Omni MedScience, Inc. versus Apple, Inc., and 21-22-13, Omni MedScience, Inc. versus Apple, Inc. Mr. Lurie.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tom Lurie, appearing for Omni MedSci. There are a number of issues we've raised in the two different appeals. Many of them are in common. But one of the focus of this appeal is about a claim limitation that requires a light source or a system configured to increase the signal-to-noise ratio of an LED in response and therefore increase the signal-to-noise ratio by increasing the pulse rate of the LED. That's the focus of today's appeal. The case or the prior art that's most common to all this is Lissagursky. The two grounds that Apple raised in the petition and the grounds that the board found made obvious that limitation were based on Lissagursky alone and Lissagursky combined with Carlson. And I want to focus on those grounds, and primarily on the Lissagursky alone side, I want to look at the board's error of law that led to a wrong conclusion. And that error of law was the board conflated the concepts of configured to with capable of. And this court has very clearly...
Well, that was only in one of the two cases, right?
No, it actually was in both cases. So in the 533 case, appendix page 30, the board said an LED is configured to increase signal to noise by increasing the LED pulse rate when it is capable of doing so, even if it does so only some of the time. And it cites the Hewlett-Packard case. And then on appendix page 36 of the 299, it has very similar language. Lissagursky's system is therefore configured to increase the signal to noise by increasing LED pulse rate, even if it does so only some of the time, citing Hewlett-Packard.
Okay, so what I'm not understanding what your theory is. What's the difference in this context between configured and capable?
Well, the court made it very clear in Parker Vision, for example, that configured to is on one side of the line and capable of is on the other side of the line.
Well, what difference does it make here? Are you suggesting that there's some requirement that it always do it? Is that
no, not that it always do it, but it has to be designed or programmed to do it. Apple says programmed, we say designed. But the system has to be designed to, in response to noise, when there's noise, it has to be designed to try to increase the signal-to-noise ratio by increasing the firing rate of the LED. Okay? If it's not doesn't have that design, then it isn't configured to. It's merely capable of.
It's a question of intent?
It's not intent. It's the way the system is designed.
And let me get this straight. I mean, in some ways, I look at the claim limitation as being self-defining when it says a light source configured to increase the signal-to-noise ratio by increasing the pulse rate. So it seems to me that the increasing the pulse rate is the configuring act that will cause the light source, the LED, to increase the signal-to-noise ratio. Is that a fair way of understanding the claim?
I would say it's the how of... So what has to be configured
and so I guess what I'm wondering is what more is required from the claim than that? Because the claim itself
a specific
says...
specific configuration.
But I don't know what you mean by specific configuration because to me it looks like the claim itself, the claim limitation itself is saying when you increase the pulse rate, the LED will have a higher signal-to-noise ratio.
Well, it doesn't say it will have, right? So that's one of the differences. Apple says
okay.
We say always.
Well, how about this?
and
it's
we don't
capable of.
No, it's got to be configured to.
I understand that there's a difference between capable of and configured to in the most general sense in our case law.
Right.
Because configured to, when we talk about it in some of our case law, not in holdings, but just in broad general discussions, we are talking about taking a device, a component, and somehow customizing it, somehow altering it, reconfiguring it, if you will, so that what that component couldn't do before it now can do, because it's been configured in some specific manner. Now, when I look at your patent specification, I don't see anything in the specification that suggests that you have taken an ordinary LED and you have somehow done anything structurally to it, or certainly nothing that would be programming anything into it. It's otherwise just an LED that when you increase its pulse rate, it's going to get this desired goal of improving the signal-to-noise ratio. So I don't see why, under that circumstance, in this particular patent, configured to doesn't mean anything more than are you increasing the pulse rate? And then if you are increasing the pulse rate, are you getting the increase in signal-to-noise ratio? What am I missing from my understanding of your patent?
I would say it's not about the LED. It's about the system, in the case of the 299 patent, or about the light source more broadly. And we put it in our briefs, figure 20.
But am I wrong in saying that there's nothing in the patent that suggests that your inventor has invented a new LED, that it has reconfigured an ordinary LED, it has structurally changed it, altered it, customized it?
Again, it's not about the LED. What he did customize and configure was the part that goes around the LED. The LED is just the light, right? But there is what the patent calls an active illuminator. And the active illuminator is actually a whole series of parts that then controls how the LED functions. Okay, so it's the active illuminator.
I saw that last minute reference to an illuminator in the patent specification, but I don't see it connected really to these claim limitations here about the light source configured to improve SNR by increasing the pulse rate. I mean, there's no discussion about increasing the pulse rate in that final paragraph about the illuminator.
It doesn't expressly say increase the pulse rate. Now, there are in the summary of the invention, it does talk about increasing the pulse rate. But in the active illuminator section, and this is in the incorporated by reference material, it's most clearly stated, but it's also in the spec of the patent itself, it talks about the active illuminator, and it says, you know, if there's signal-to-noise issue, you can increase the signal-to-noise using an active illuminator. In the case of sunlight, or if there's, you know, variations in cloudiness and things like that.
Well, so, you know, we're running out of time here. Let's assume for the moment that we don't understand the claim limitation in the same way as you, and we understand it as simply there's no subjective intent element, and as long as a prior art light source or an accused infringing light source is, when you increase its pulse rate, it yields an increase in SNR, then it would meet the limitation. So what else is...
The prior art teaches increasing the pulse rate, right?
It actually doesn't, and let me explain why. I've got figure 8B here. And this is Lysogirsky, and this is an illustration of how it works. So this is the PPG signal on top, the heart rate. And what Lysogirsky says is that one way to make sure you're finding the peaks and the valleys of the heart rate is to pulse the LED on the peaks or the valleys. So that's what it does at the bottom here. And the way it does that is it has this signal on top. It's two LEDs. One LED is always on, looking for the peaks and valleys.
Well, that's one thing it teaches, but the board found that it also teaches increasing the pulse rate, right?
So, what it does is to match the heart rate. So if the heart rate changes, then the pulses for the CCM, cardiac cycle modulation, will also follow the change in heart rate. So there will be an increase in the pulse rate for that scenario. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't react to noise by increasing the firing rate to increase SNR. If it did that, these pulses would be closer together. They would no longer line up with the heart rate.
My understanding is, though, that the board in both of these appeals relied on what it saw as an admission in the patent owner response about how you would acknowledge that in Lesogorsky that it increases SNR in multiple different ways, and one of them is by modulating the light signal in accordance with the cardiac cycle.
Correct.
And so, therefore, it, once the board had that information in front of it, it understood that when the heart rate rises, the pulse rate's necessarily going to rise with that. And then now we have what looks like your claim limitation about improving signal-to-noise ratio by increasing the pulse rate.
But that's what there's no evidence of. There's no evidence that that fact, what you just said, increases the signal-to-noise ratio.
But what about
all we
the
have
admission,
is speculation.
What about the admission that Lesogorsky teaches multiple different ways of improving SNR?
Yes, and it teaches specifically four ways of doing that, none of which are increase the pulse rate of the LED. And it's because if you did that, if you increased the pulse rate of the LED, you would go off the heart rate. So,
okay, but quite apart from the cardiac embodiment, the board found alternatively that the combination of Lesogorsky and Carlson shows increasing the pulse rate to 5,000 hertz for the stated purpose of improving the signal-to-noise ratio, right? What's wrong with that?
Well, there's no increase in the pulse rate.
From 0 to 5,000?
No. No. So, actually, the concurrence said that. The board implicitly rejected that. There's no pulses at, quote-unquote, 0 hertz. It's not pulsing. So you can't, it's a non-existent pulse rate. You can't say there's a pulse rate for something that doesn't pulse.
Your theory is that starting to pulse. It doesn't show increase.
No,
in
it just,
pulse rate.
It's on or off.
That's your theory. Right.
It's on or off. There's no increase. And the Lesogorsky, let me tell you why we think the combination the board made is incorrect, because they didn't give a reason to make this combination. So Lesogorsky, this line I have here on figure 8B, that's normally always on. But Lesogorsky says, if there's noise, what you can do is you can go from always on to pulsing at 1,000 hertz. All right? So noise, you want to solve noise problem, you can pulse this always on LED at 1,000 hertz. That's exactly the same thing Carlson says. No different. Carlson says LED's always on.
That's the DCM mode.
That's the DCM mode, right.
Right. But Lesogorsky says you can have the DCM mode going on at the same time as another mode.
As CCM, right. Cycle modulation. So the top LED would be flashing at 1,000 hertz.
The trouble we have here is that, you know, we're in appeals court, and mm-hmm. I feel like what's happening here is an attempt to relitigate all these fact findings about how these references operate or don't operate, and we have to defer to the board's fact findings ultimately. And if the board found that Lesogorsky does talk about moving into a second mode to deal with background noise, and Lesogorsky would already be at a very low frequency in CCM mode, and then if you combine Carlson's teaching of, oh, when you're dealing with a lot of background environmental noise, you should yank your pulse rate up to 1,000 hertz, and then when Lesogorsky already talks about exiting CCM to a second mode, why wouldn't that be obvious then to just have the second mode of Lesogorsky be operating at 1,000 hertz pulse rate?
The reason is because there's no reason an ordinary artisan would effectively throw away Lesogorsky's teaching of DCM, which is identical to Carlson's teaching, right? So you got Schweikert, you got NTP, those cases say where the first reference already has the feature, you have to give some reason to get rid of it, and it's working, get rid of it, and put in place of it the feature, same feature from another reference. And that's exactly what the board did.
Okay. So if we were to conclude that the board was correct about the motivation to combine, you agree that the combination shows the patented limitation?
No, because the second problem is it changes the principle of operation of Lesogorsky.
Okay, CCM put that aside. It was okay. we say there's a motivation, there's no problem about changing the principle of operation. The combination shows the limitation, right?
Well, if there's a reason to do it, and it's not changing the principle of operation, then the board made a combination, and it does what the claim requires. I don't disagree with that, but I think the other two fundamental problems are that they didn't give a reason why you would get rid of DCM. And I see my red light's on, but...
Okay, well, we'll unless Chief Judge Moore has any questions, hearing none, thank you, Mr. Liu. We'll give you 2 minutes. Mr. Cushion?
Cushion for Apple. Judge Chen, toward the end of your remarks, you made a good observation that this is not the place to relitigate all of the factual disputes that were before the board, and really that's what this case is about. Sorry about that.
Could you just go to the opposing counsel's last point about DCM mode and respond to their theory about why it doesn't make any sense to make this particular combination in light of the DCM mode already operating at 1,000 hertz?
So the short answer is that before the board, they did not dispute that a person of skill would have combined the teachings of Lissagirsky and Carlson. In the Omni 1 decision, at Appendix 24-25, the board made a finding that the two references teach complementary designs and techniques in analogous systems, including techniques for achieving the same objectives of increasing SNR in the presence of environmental noise, such as ambient light or sunlight. And as the board points out, Omni did not dispute these findings. This theory that they're advancing now is trying to reverse that determination by the board that a person would have combined the teachings of the two references. He's also suggested that the teachings are essentially superfluous. There's no difference in the teachings between the two references. And I think here it's important to appreciate that two things. For the combination of Lissagirsky and Carlson, and contrary to what Mr. Lurie said, that determination does not depend on you affirming the PTAB's claim construction. In both cases, that finding was something we flagged in our briefs as not dependent on that claim construction determination, and they have not disputed that. And what that tells you is that you can address that issue based on the standard of substantial evidence and conclude, as you should, that it does teach the combination. Now, the thing that's particularly important about the combination is that what Carlson is adding to Lissagirsky is the reason why you should increase the LED pulse rate. In their challenge to Lissagirsky alone, that's what they say is missing. The reason why you should increase the pulse rate is to increase the SNR. And that's exactly what the board found was being provided, that teaching to increase the pulse rate, to go to that high-frequency LED pulse rate in order to increase the SNR and thereby overcome ambient noise. And the findings are laid out very concisely by the panel.
Right, but my question is, just following up on what your opposing counsel said, his argument is there already is this DCM mode operating at 1,000 hertz in Lissagirsky that is dealing with environmental noise. So why would one of skill be motivated to change Lissagirsky to exit from CCM at the same time and yank that pulse rate up to 1,000 hertz?
Because Lissagirsky identifies a variety of ways of dealing with ambient noise when it encounters it, and it says you can alter several of the parameters of the pulse rate. They've challenged that Lissagirsky taught when it does alter its behavior, going to a high-frequency pulse rate to solve that problem. That's what their challenge to Lissagirsky's teaching was. And so in the combination with Carlson, Carlson is coming in and providing that reason to change the pulse rate to a high-frequency rate in order to increase the signal-to-noise ratio. And that's also why this theory of superfluous teachings is incorrect, because Lissagirsky, according to them, is not teaching that solution to the problem of noise when it's operating in that low-frequency cardiac cycle modulation mode. And that's why this board's decision disposes of the issues. The board saw that the Lissagursky device operates in a low-frequency mode in CCM. It teaches that when it encounters ambient noise, it switches to a second mode. It lists a variety of options for how it might deal with that increased noise. And now Carlson comes in and provides a specific idea of solving that problem of ambient noise by increasing the LED pulse rate and thereby yields the increased signal-to-noise ratio. Now, I'd like to touch on a couple of points on the claim construction arguments that we've heard. And I think the discussion that you've went through with Mr. Lurie identifies exactly what the board saw, which is there's nothing there in the specification in the claim language besides the LEDs. The LEDs are passive devices. They are capable of being pulsed in different ways. And in front of the board really strained to get Omni to identify where in the specification it described a specific configuration or this technique of responding to noise and then doing something to alter the pulse rate. And the only thing that Omni identified was this active illuminator section. Now, what's particularly probative about that conversation is, and this is particularly and also in the oral hearing, is that the active illuminator section lists a few ways of increasing the signal-to-noise ratio. None of them are by responding to light and adapt and changing the pulse rate to increase it to overcome the signal-to-noise ratio.
Well, this is all seems to me a bit confusing. Basically, it's configured to meet the claim limitation because it's established, it's programmed so that in response to noise, it increases the pulse rate. And that's what the combination produces that configuration, right?
I don't think that's quite accurate for this case. What the issue here is, and if you look at the briefing, they're basically...
What's inaccurate about what I said?
There's nothing in the claim language that has some component that does that. There's nothing in the specification that shows doing that. And so the only thing that we're really fighting about is whether configured to, just by those two words alone, cause or create a configuration.
If you interpret the claim as requiring the respond to a noise problem by increasing the pulse rate, that would be what the program is.
Well, the board found no language that suggests that the claim requires a response to noise and then taking action. All it says is
well, that's what they're arguing, is that's what the claim requires.
And he tried to convince the board of that as well, and he did not succeed. The board did not find a basis for reading the claim the way he proposed it. And I think what this case boils down to is that he's taken the position that the words configured to by themselves create this special...
I mean, I thought the whole point of bringing in Carlson is it shows increasing the pulse rate to deal... or using a high pulse rate to deal with a noise problem, being responsive to the existence of noise. So the theory is if that is part of the claim, the combination of Carlson and Lissagursky does that.
That is absolutely correct, and that's why we add that as an alternative ground.
So just to be clear then, if it's your view that if we agree with Omni's understanding of the claim limitation, that it doesn't make a difference with respect to the Lissagursky-Carlson combination?
Correct.
It would make a difference with the Lissagursky alone theory for meeting the limitation.
Well, I think we would dispute that as well, because the only thing that you end up with in their construction is an intent of a device, right? And you've seen cases where intent doesn't get counted.
Maybe not intent, but this whole response conception that Judge Dyke is exploring with you, the idea that in response to increased noise, in order to get the signal-to-noise ratio to be at an acceptable level, then you increase the pulse rate.
I would submit
Lissagursky alone doesn't quite have that idea.
Lissagursky alone, well, that's an interesting question because one of the things you'll see in the briefing is a little bit of vacillation about what Lissagursky says about why it's increasing the pulse rate. If you look in their...
It's increasing the pulse rate to match the heart rate. So if the heart rate happens to go up, then your pulse rate will get increased.
But you're relying on their admission, which seems to suggest that that's what Ludogorsky does with the increase in the pulse rate in the cardiac situation.
The admission was one thing in front of the board that they relied on. There was additional evidence. The board looked at a passage in the Ludogorsky description and basically confirmed that the signal to noise was increasing in the CCM mode. We also
that's not responsive to this notion that it has to do it in response to a noise problem. But the admission does seem to cover that.
Well, I think one of the things that's challenging about reading their claim is having this additional requirement. We have a whole body of case law where the court has found it improper to read a limitation into the claim from an example in the specification. Here, you have a situation where the board found no example, but that somehow would still feed that example's requirements into the claim language. I don't think the board saw any rationale for permitting that. They looked at the claim language. In the Omni One case, the thing that the claim identified was an LED, a plurality of LEDs. That was the only structure it identified. And then it had the outcome of doing something to that structure. That led to the conclusion that it is capable, in that case, of achieving the SNR. And we should also be clear that Omni has made absolutely clear statements that when the device is in operation, it does not necessarily increase the signal-to-noise ratio. And that makes this case fit precisely into the Hewlett-Packard type of rationale. So if you take the board's finding that in the cardiac cycle mode, sometimes it increases the SNR by increasing the LED pulse rate. It's not a matter of can you configure it to do it possibly. They found it does increase the signal-to-noise ratio by increasing the LED pulse rate under Hewlett-Packard. That is sufficient to meet the requirement for a claim of that nature. In the Omni 2 case, the claim focused on the system as a whole. And there's really no dispute. There's no fight about this because there's no question Ludogorsky and Carlson both describe systems that have something in them that do this, that increase the pulse rate to increase the signal-to-noise ratio.
I find the law very confusing on the question of when does a prior art reference have to meet a claim limitation all the time versus some of the times. And I see to your benefit, you're leaning on the arm of case law that says if the prior art meets the limitation some of the time, that's good enough for this claim. But it's less than clear to me that that is the case in this facts here when we do have a claim, after all, that says a light source or a system configured to increase the signal-to-noise ratio by increasing the pulse rate.
Well, I think what you see
it seems to me it's not an absurd construction of this claim to suggest that it's dealing with a situation where in response to a noise problem, an interference problem, and a desire to increase the signal-to-noise ratio, you increase the pulse rate. I mean, it's not a unsupported notion of how to construe the claim.
Well, Your Honor, I think the question is, does this claim by its language or by the description of this element in the specification describe a configuration that does that? And this goes to your question, Judge Chen. The cases are not asking what configured to in the abstract means. They're asking what does a claim term require? What does a claim term define? And then the role of words like adapted to or configured to with the rest of the claim language and the specification is being evaluated. The upshot of all these cases is there a configuration? Is there a specific device? Is there some requirement that things be done beyond what's listed in the claim that cause the result? And if the result, and so that's one part of the confusion, is that the cases don't just look at configure to in isolation. They look to see if it is defining a configuration.
Okay, but their argument is that accidentally performing the thing is not sufficient. The device has to be programmed to increase the signal-to-noise ratio as a result of an increased pulse rate when a noise problem is detected.
And that's not our...
You don't agree with that, but your alternative theory, as I understand it, is that that's in fact what the combination of Litigersky and Carlson does show.
I think, well, our position is that...
You don't say that?
Well, I want to home in on one point of what you said. Our position and the record shows that the board found that it doesn't, it's not a possibility, it does happen in the CCM mode. The pulse rate increases. So this is the case that is defined by Hewlett-Packard, which says if you have a device and some of the times in its operation it does achieve the result, then it satisfies the claim limitation.
Well,
this is not the case.
Their construction. Under their construction, the increase in the pulse rate has to be responsive to a noise problem. Is not your alternative theory that the combination of Litigersky and Carlson does that?
Yes. So the second point, yes.
I don't think so. Yeah.
First point, we don't agree, and I don't think the board agreed with them either, that there is that element that's missing that yields that result or causes that result.
If we were to affirm the Litigersky-Carlson combination, but not adopt the board's construction, because maybe we prefer the construction that Judge Dyke is been hypothesizing about. Is that going to impact any parallel litigation?
There is a third IPR proceeding pending right now, and the case of the district court litigation is stayed pending the disposition of the IPRs. So I would have to take a closer look at the claim language to see if it maps over to the issues we're dealing with here, but right now, these two cases are linked pretty closely on the issues we've talked about.
Okay. Unless Chief Judge Moore has any questions, I think that's it for Mr. Fisher. Okay, Mr. Lurie, you have 2 minutes.
To answer Judge Chen's last question, we have to win both. If we don't win both, then the effect is the same as if we just win one. So
well,
we have
for purposes of this case, of course, I understand.
Yeah,
I'm
but even
about
follow-on cases,
any other follow-on cases.
At least the ones that have been, the other IPR has the same issues.
Okay.
So there are some dependent claims that don't apply, but they have nothing to do with this. But let me address a couple of different points on the Litigersky-Carlson combination. Apple's counsel said that we didn't dispute the combination that they made. And writ large, the fact that these two references are similar and have some ability to be combined, we don't dispute that. But what we did dispute was the specific combination the board tried to make. And that's, for example, the Schweikert case that we cited, which is a non-precedential case. The NTP case is precedential. But in Schweikert, there were two references. They were basically the same exact thing as the Litigersky-Carlson here, in the sense that they were very similar references. But what the board had done was take a piece of the first reference, taken it out, and put in a piece from the second reference. And the court said, well, you can't do that where the pieces are the same. And here we get the exact same two pieces. You have to have a reason. It's not that you can't do it, but you have to give a reason to do that specific combination. And that's what we're arguing. But the board didn't give a reason for the specific combination of taking the 1,000 hertz DCM that does exactly what Carlson does. And it's column 6 of Litigersky, he says, if there's noise, we can use drive cycle modulation 1,000 hertz. That's exactly what Carlson says. And Carlson does not say increase the pulse rate. He said the thing missing from Litigersky was the reason to increase the pulse rate. But Carlson doesn't increase the pulse rate. In fact, the board declined to make that finding, said it wasn't necessary to make that finding, that there's an increase in pulse rate in Carlson. Okay? So the things that they need to make the Carlson-Litigersky combination don't exist.
Okay, you're out of time.
Thank you,
Mr. Lurie.
Thank you,
Mr. Fishman. The cases are submitted.